The following podcast is brought to you by the Jonas Podcasting Network, found exclusively at WrestlingWithJonas.com. And welcome to the latest episode of Wrestling with Jonas, episode 339, and what a way to spend our Wednesday evening with legendary wrestler from North America, one of the very best tag team wrestlers to ever come out of the States, and the current head coach at JPWA over in Knoxville, Tennessee, the Doctor of Desire, Tom Pritchard. How are you doing, sir? And thank you for joining me.
John, thank you for having me. What a great night it is to be on your show. Thank you very much. It's a little chilly here, and I understand it's a little chilly there, huh?
It is. I've had to put over one of them foil blankets over my windscreen to kind of cut out the frost, and hopefully I can just lift that in the morning, get to work without any scraping. But we shall see. It is a cold one over here in the UK and over where you are as well. But thank you so much for joining me. And over the next hour, hour 15, during the course of this live interview, you can send in your questions. If you're watching us live on YouTube, Twitch, X, Facebook Live, wherever you're watching us, thank you so much for joining us, sending your questions, sending your comments for Dr. Tom, anything about JPWA, anything about Tom's glorious 45 year career now in the business, Tom? Yeah, how many years are you in the business?
Yeah. Well, actually, if you want to start back when I was 12 years old and I started taking pictures for the magazine, it was 50 years. But actually, I started wrestling in 1979, so 44 years.
Wow.
Of being in the wrestling business. Long time.
Absolutely. But sending your questions, we are live. I see one or two questions drop through already. But just a quick reminder before we take a deep dive with Tom of some of my recent guests, some names that Dr. Tom might be familiar with. But just a couple of weeks ago, I had Dirty Dango, an in-car interview with Dirty Dango, something I've never done before. But I was honoured to have Dirty Dango in my company for 24 hours over here in the UK while I was looking after him. But a really great interview. Go and check that one out on my YouTube channel. Also, episode 7 of my Legends Masterclass series featuring one of the very best wrestlers to ever lace up a pair of boots, Johnny Saint, British wrestling legend, world of sport legend, Johnny Saint. Part 1 and now part 2 is out on all audio platforms and YouTube. Like I say, please go check out my YouTube. Really trying to build the subscribers numbers there. But today, it's all about this guy here. The Doctor of Desire, Dr. Tom Pritchard. And Tom, it's been another busy year for you over at JPWA, and you've just signed off your latest set of graduates, your latest set of recruits. There you go. You've got yourself a few weeks free time now to enjoy the holiday season. Sum up your 2023 for us, because it's been another glorious year for JPWA, hasn't it?
Well, let me ask you this real quick before we get into that. Yeah, I want to know how Dango came over there for 24 hours. You spent a day with him?
Well, I picked him up from the airport a few Saturdays ago, drove him to my house where he kind of slept in my guest room for a few hours.
Awesome.
And then off to his hotel, got him checked in. And then he did a seminar and a show that I was helping to run that evening. And then strangely, and this is a story that he tells in the interview, he left his mobile phone in my car. I didn't know until the following morning, but he was obviously frantic in his hotel room looking for his bloody mobile phone all the time. Oh. It was in my car. I found it like the following morning. So I thought, I've got to get this to him because he's going to be going crazy. So back at 8 o'clock in the morning, knocked on his door. There he was, bleary eyed. Only his head was poking around the corner, gave his phone back. He was mightily relieved. And then I saw him again an hour later. We did that interview before I took him to his next gig. But he was very, very excited, Tom, when I told him that you were going to be coming on my show, because he said, oh, you've got to tell Dr. Tom that you spent a bit of time with me and say hi from Dango, because you were one of his trainers, weren't you?
That's right. And he's a very good guy. That's what I was wanting to know, because if you know him, then you know him. And if you had fun with him, then you'll know you had a lot of fun. Yeah. He's a really good guy. And that's very cool. And Johnny Saint, I'm a big fan of too, going back to the world of sports. So that's awesome, man. I really do think that it is awesome. But going back to your original question, 2023, We just experienced a hell of a year. The summer class was the biggest class we had this year, with some guys that you know very well, Toby St. John, Jordan Sparks, Ruby and Echo. And it was an awesome time. We had a blast. I had a blast. I think we had 12 people in that class, and they got to go to the NWA. They got to go to some shows and really enjoy themselves. And we had a great time having them.
Absolutely. Got a few pictures here. Well, this is the class that Toby St. John, Jordan Sparks, Ruby Manitoba, and Echo were graduates of. And I think that was possibly one of their last shows that they worked on and performed on while they were over in Knoxville. There they are. And I've got to say that they really were. I mean, I've spoken to all four of them since they came back from JPWA in, I think that was October, early October. They came back to the UK. And they took away so much from spending 3 months in your company, 3 months at JPWA. And of course, this is the most recent class of graduates there. Obviously, you've got the big man on the left-hand side there, Mr. Glenn Jacobs, Hall of Famer, otherwise known as Kane, of course. Like I say, it's been another successful year. I mean, when did JPWA kind of form, Tom? And I mean, I'm guessing there was a conversation between yourself and Mr. Jacobs about starting up a training academy. Tell us about how it all started.
Glenn was running his campaign for Knox County Mayor here in Knoxville, Tennessee. And we were at lunch one day talking about the campaign and talking about what we were going to do. And I told him that I was on my way to Atlanta for a seminar, and the next day was an event, and Glenn pulled me aside and said, "Hey, you know what? How many seminars do you do a day or a year?" And I told him sometimes six, anywhere from 6 to 12 seminars a year, and sometimes more, sometimes less. And he said, "Why don't we form a school? You ever thought of doing a school here in Knoxville? If you're here, I'm here, and it might work." And I thought, oh, man, I don't know if I want to do this or not. And then I thought about it, and I said, well, hold on. You know, Kane, Glenn Jacobs, one of the most recognizable characters, one of the biggest, most successful characters in professional wrestling.
Yeah.
Yeah, forming a partnership with him, how can you go wrong? So we formed this in 2019, you know, right before COVID hit, and just had a go for it. You know, we had a place in Knoxville for a good 4 years. And then we had to move to La Follette, Tennessee, which is 45 minutes from Knoxville now, but it's in a lot better place. It's got all the facilities we need. It's got heat. It doesn't have air. And that's what the guys were telling me, you know, Toby and Jordan, Ruby and Echo were saying, man, they like the cool weather. And, well, the summer times here in Tennessee can get pretty brutal. And
they said it was warm. They said it was warm conditions for sure.
It was hot. It was more than warm. It was hot, man. So we've been doing this now since 2019, and we've had people from all over the country, all over the world come to us, from India, England, France, Sweden, Switzerland, Austria, Germany. So, you know, we've been very fortunate having people come all over the place to get trained.
Absolutely. I just want to switch things back to when the four UK talents, Toby St. John there on the left-hand side, Ruby Manitoba, Echo, and then Jordan Sparks on the right-hand side, when they came over for your summer class. And I think one thing that really fascinates me, certainly about Jordan and Toby, the blockbusters, they're very good as singles wrestlers, but as a tag team, the blockbusters, they're one of the best tag teams over here in the UK and just getting better. I think they pride themselves on kind of being maybe old school, maybe a little bit of a throwback. They're young guys. They're in their 20s, and they're huge fans of the territory days and the type of wrestling that you would probably enjoy and hark back to, Tom. Was that refreshing for yourself, especially, you know, having some Brits come over from the UK to Knoxville and having that same passion that you have?
Yeah, and it's one of those things that the fundamentals and basics never go out of style. Yes, you have to keep up with the times, and yes, you have to have exciting action. You have to do what the fans want. You know, the guy who broke me in, Paul Bosch, once said, you know, he paraphrased it, and I'll paraphrase it as well. He said, you know, I like to go fishing, and I also like strawberries. And when I go fishing, I put worms on the hook because that's what fish like, and I'm trying to catch fish. So if you're trying to get wrestling fans to come to your shows, you give them what they like, not necessarily what I like. But I've found that old school wrestling, if done correctly and done with a passion, it can be exciting. It can be entertaining. It's storytelling. And storytelling never goes out of style either. That's what professional wrestling is. It's telling stories, compelling stories with compelling people, characters. I hate the word character. But at the same time, that's what it is. Different characters and different personas that people can get into. What is it that makes you special? And why would people pay to come out from their house and come and see you? Well, it's telling that story and getting people interested. I think over this past, this past year, the Bloodline was a compelling story. You just had CM Punk come back over here. And what a story that is. Mm. You know, who is Punk going to go after? Is he gonna, he's going after Seth Rollins? Yes, but you still have Roman Reigns. You have Cody Rhodes. You have all these elements in play now. And it's going to be interesting to see how many people come back or stay with the product. So it all goes back to old school storytelling. And I think CM Punk and some of these guys that are even on the roster today for WWE are old school guys that understand, yes, you need the flip, flop, and fly, but you also need purpose and meaning behind everything you do for anybody to really care. Because if you don't have any passion behind it, then it's just moves strung together. And that's not bad sometimes, but at the same time, if I could tell a story real quick, if you walked into your house and I told you I was going to try and get by without cussing, but I have to say it like this. If you come into your house and there's two elephants out there fucking, you're going to come in and go, holy shit, there's two elephants out there fucking. Holy shit. If you come in the next day and those two elephants are still out there, so holy shit, those two elephants are still out there fucking. By the third day, it's, there's those fucking elephants. It loses the effect. So you can do so much, so many times, and if you don't take your time and tell a story with it and add to it, excuse me, I'm going to get this frog in my throat eventually, add to it with the passion and the meanings behind the moves, it'll mean more. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that's what I found refreshing when Toby and Jordan and Ruby and Echo came in, because they understood storytelling. They understood that there is more than just going out there doing moves for the sake of doing moves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, somebody that's watching us live via Facebook now, their name won't come up, but I think this is a gentleman by the name of Johnny Glow, and he asks quite an interesting question. What does Dr. Tom think wrestling is missing today? So you mentioned the Bloodline, and I think that WWE and AEW and NWA and various promotions do tell some quite compelling stories, and I think it has got better over the last year or 2 years. Wrestling is like ice cream, isn't it? It depends what flavor ice cream you fancy on any given day. But is there anything in particular, any elements you feel is missing from modern day wrestling?
At times, I think the passion is missing. People want to get into wrestling today for a different reason than I wanted to get into it. When I got in, I wanted to live the life of a professional wrestler, be on the road, going from town to town, getting in the ring, telling a story, and coming back and going to the next town, doing it again. There was nothing more exciting to me than living that life. And I think today, and I could be wrong, but this is just, again, my opinion, people are getting into wrestling for other reasons, and they want to be famous, and they want to be movie stars, and they want to do all these things that wrestling helps them accomplish. When I got in, that's all I want to do is wrestle. That's what I love. And I don't know if the love and the passion is necessarily as prevalent today as it once was. I could be wrong, but that's what I think is missing. Just that work ethic, that the love of professional wrestling.
I understand. Let me ask you about a typical week at JPWA. So tell us a little bit about kind of what happens on certain days of the week, what classes happen on certain days of the week, and what sort of training regiments you put your students through when you have your classes.
Well, we do 5 days a week, and Monday and Tuesday, Thursday and Friday are all in ring training, and Wednesday we save for promos. We do an advanced class from 3 to 6, and we do 6 to 10 for the beginners. And the advanced class is really just people coming in and working on what they want to work on. If they want to try something new, they want to review a match or go over something, that's what I call the advanced class. Then we get the beginners class, and we do 4 hours. 4 hours is a long time. So we take breaks, obviously, but that's Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday. Then Wednesday, we dedicate 2 hours to promos. Sometimes we go a little longer, but I believe promos and being able to talk is so essential, especially today's wrestling business. If you watch anything, Raw, SmackDown, NXT, I just watched NXT last night, the promos, the storytelling that you have to be able to do, you have to be able to talk. And so we dedicate a day to that. And the rest of the time, it's in ring and learning the basics and fundamentals. Once again, you have to have a structure, and you have to have something to build on, a strong foundation. Otherwise, you can go out and you do have a corona or a toupee or her corona and a tope, either way you want to say it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But if you can't lock up, if you can't do a headlock takeover, and I paid attention last night, and I paid attention on Monday night, when I was able to watch Raw, you know, I watched Cody Rhodes take Shinsuke Nakamura over in a headlock and sit there for about 5 seconds. But I mean, they came back up. At the same time, not everybody knows how to take a headlock or do a headlock takeover. Those are the basics and fundamentals that you have to have down before you can start thinking about going to the top rope or diving on somebody outside. And that's what we go over.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me ask you, obviously you've got the J of the JPWA is for Jacobs, Glenn Jacobs, and I brought up his picture early, Hall of Famer, otherwise known as Kane. But where did the two of you first kind of get this friendship going? Would it have been during your Smoky Mountain days? Because I think he kind of was starting off around that time in that same area, wasn't he?
Yeah, that's where I met Glenn for the first time. And then when he went to WWF, we connected there as well. And then he moved to Knoxville. He married a girl from Knoxville. And when I moved back, we reconnected. So, absolutely. You know, it's been a on and off friendship for a while now.
But this is it, friendships in wrestling. When you do hook up with somebody that you've not seen for years, it's almost like it was yesterday.
Right. That's exactly how it was.
Absolutely. And we got to talk. Watching us live of our YouTube. Thank you, Tori. What is it like working with Kane, Glenn Jacobs, with training the students? So is Glenn an active part of your weekly kind of day-to-day and training of the students? I know that he's a busy guy. I think he's still the mayor of Knoxville, isn't he?
He's mayor of Knox County. He occasionally will come down and talk to the guys, but more so than not, he was at the last graduation, as you saw in the picture. But he will come down occasionally and just check out the crew and offer some advice and offer some words of wisdom, but not on a regular basis. I mean, it is a full-time job being the mayor of Knox County.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Yeah. I'm sure it is. Yeah. And he's doing a very, very good job of it as well, from what I hear. I want to talk about some success stories from JPWA. And you mentioned NXT, and there's two individuals that are performing on NXT on a weekly basis. And in fact, I stand corrected, because one of them is actually on the main roster now, and that's Ivy Nile, doing some great things. And I think she had a great match this past Monday, and I think she set herself up for a championship match down the line. And of course, you got Stax Lorenzo, Channing Lorenzo. But I mean, they're just two of many success stories that you've had recently, certainly with JPWA in the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, tell us about those two individuals in particular, because they're doing some great things. And I think Channing is also the current NXT, or one half of the NXT Tag Team Champions. So they're both doing some wonderful work, thanks in part to the training and the knowledge you gave them.
Well, Stax came to us. I think he was in the second class of JPWA. And
really?
He wanted to make sure, you know, he had done a Totino's commercial for video for a Totino's commercial, Totino's pizza commercial that they were advertising at the time. And he was the mother lover, Jake Tucker. He was living in his mom's front yard in a camper outside. And
that's a great name, by the way.
Yeah. The mother lover, Jake Tucker. Yeah. So, and he was very entertaining. He would cut these promos. He and his, partner in JPWA, Cam Houston, they would cut these vignettes and do these entertaining promos, and it got him noticed. And he was determined. He came in out of shape. I don't want to say out of shape. He wasn't in great shape. He wasn't in the shape he's in now, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
But when he came to us, he made it evident, made it clear to me that he wanted to go to WWE. That was his goal. And I believe there's three kinds of people in the world: those who try, those who give it the best shot, and those who do whatever it takes. And he did whatever it took to get him noticed, to get him there, and to train with some people in Florida. He trained with Natty Neidhart and TJ Wilson. You know, they don't have a school, but they have a ring in their out by their house, and they train certain people. And he got in with that clique, and he got noticed. And He never let up. Now he's on NXT, one half of the tag team champions. And I don't think it's going to be before long when he gets on the main roster. He's doing a great job. Ivy Nile this past week, she came out with Maxine Dupri, and she made the challenge to Rhea Ripley. Yeah. So, I mean, and she's doing tremendous. She came to us. I think she was in the same class as Jake. So, you know, it can be done. I truly believe if you will it, so it will be done, man. If you want something bad enough, you'll work for it and get it.
Absolutely. Now, outside of JPWA, I know that certainly for the last 28 years, maybe longer, you're credited with training some of the biggest names in the industry, Hall of Famers, or certainly first ballot Hall of Famers, but the likes of the Hardy Boys, Bray Wyatt, the Bella Twins, Natty Neidhart, you mentioned her earlier, Adam Copeland or Edge, Kurt Angle, and so many more in OVW, Deep South, FCW, and NXT. I mean, as I mentioned, that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg as far as the people that you are credited with training. And we'll talk about another individual in just a moment, but that's a pretty impressive list. I mean, when you were training some of those individuals, did you notice, or did you think to yourself, yeah, this guy or gal, this individual has got what it takes and I can see them going all the way?
Sure. Sometimes you can see it. Sometimes I've been wrong before. I've been wrong about some people. I've been wrong about one Hall of Famer. I don't want to mention his name. But that I never thought would make it. But it just went to show me, I can show you what I know, and I can tell you what I know. But you have to have the talent to do it. It's like the 10,000 hour rule. They used to say if you did something for 10,000 hours over and over, you become an expert. Then they amended that and said, well, you also have to have some talent. Yes, I also have to be able to pull it off. Well, it's the same thing with wrestling. You can train with some great trainers, but you have to have the talent. You have to have that innate ability to feel this. This is a feeling business. This is the entertainment business. It's sports, yes, and it is physical, no doubt. But without that innate ability to entertain and have people care about you, then it doesn't mean anything. So, you know, when you watch the Kurt Angle, when I locked up with Kurt the first time, here's an athlete, a gold medalist, who has nothing. I have nothing to prove to Kurt Angle. And I told him when we first locked up, Kurt, I have nothing to prove to you, so don't kill me. When we locked up, he understood what this was. He had it. He got it. He was right there with me. So, you know, you have to have that if you're going to be successful. You have to understand what this is and how to get it. And it takes a lot of practice, repetition. And sometimes you go out there, and no matter how much you go over a match, there's going to be things that happen. There's going to be elements of the match that may not go exactly how you want them to go. And if you have everything planned out from A, B, C, D, E, and you get to C and something messes up, you don't know how to get to the rest of it, then you're screwed. So that's one reason why we go over the basics and fundamentals over and over and over until, I believe, don't do it until you get it right. Do it until you can't get it wrong. And then it'll become second nature to you. And all those guys you mentioned had that second nature about professional wrestling. They didn't do it until they got it right. They didn't until they just couldn't get it wrong. You know, to me, it's so foreign to lock up with somebody and grab a headlock with the right arm. It just, there's no way I could do it. It wouldn't work. Yeah. And I still see people when they come in and start their training, some people will still grab with the right arm. And it's just because they don't know yet. They don't know the correct way. And again, there's your way, there's my way, and the right way, the only way, does not exist. There's nothing etched in stone that says this is the only way to train. This is the only way to do it. No such thing. You can do it this way or that way. Wrestling is just an opinion. And as you mentioned earlier, different flavors of ice cream. You know, I like Rocky Road. Some people like strawberry. And I do headlock this way. Some people may do a headlock that way. Either way, if it works, it works.
Yeah, good point. Good advice. This little bit is at the top of your website from Adam Copeland, Edge. Let me just kind of get in here. Tom is the doctor of everything, who has touched the minds of more of us than you will ever know, from WWE Hall of Famer Edge. And he was one of the names that we mentioned earlier on. But one person I want to talk about in particular is this guy here. I don't know if you've ever heard of this guy, but it's quite big in the movie world, Dwayne Johnson. I'm kidding. It's The Rock, yeah. Of course. Now, I understand how the story goes is that back in about 95, maybe 96, Vince came up to you and asked you to kind of maybe take some students under your wing. They hadn't done a developmental or a proper kind of training before in-house. And there was this warehouse within WWF Studios at the time. And you had, I think, Mark Henry, Bracus, and Rock, or Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, Rocky Maivia, as your first three students. Of course, we know what that guy went on to do, you know, became one of the biggest names in the wrestling industry and now the biggest name in the movie industry. But what do you remember about them kind of early days, 96, and a certain Dwayne Johnson coming your way?
Well, it was awesome, man, because it was just those three guys and myself in the warehouse of the studio where we were working all day long. We'd go have breakfast at Titan Towers and go work out in the gym and head over to the studio. And back then in 1996, you know, I was coming off the road and I was still in wrestling shape. So I was getting in the ring with all three of those guys. And I was taking the bumps and Brockus was brand spanking new. Mark Henry was brand spanking new. Rock had already been to Memphis for a little bit. And he came in to get ready for Survivor Series. So, It was awesome, really awesome, because Rock was one of those guys, very excited to be there, a natural smartass in a good way. You know what I mean? Where you joke around and you can have fun. And you need to have fun in this business, because if not, it's going to be drudgery and you're going to hate it. But I remember Rock was a natural. Mark and Occam weren't so much naturals, but they were big guys. You know, Mark Henry broke his leg. I think his first month there, hitting the ropes, and his ankle got snapped in the mat and snapped his ankle. But it was an awesome time to be there. It was one of those things where WCW had the power plant. Vince didn't have a developmental system and he wanted to try it. And I got the opportunity to do it. I'm so happy I did. You know, after that, Dory Funk Jr. came in and we did the Funkin' Dojo for I don't know how long, 4 months, 5 months, whatever it was. And then we moved the developmental system down to Louisville and Cincinnati and kind of had different places. But it was an awesome time to be there in the beginning.
Absolutely. Now, I just want to quickly switch back to JPWA. And if there's any aspiring young wrestlers, whether it be over here in the UK? You said that you have truly international talent travel from around the world to Knoxville to train with you. But if anybody's interested in spending 3 months with you and kind of learning under the learning tree of Dr. Tom Pritchard, how can they get in touch? How can they kind of make their first steps to kind of spending 3 months over in Knoxville?
Well, the best way I could tell you is if you go to jpwrestlingacademy.com, it'll tell you all the information. It'll have an application you can fill out, and it'll come to us. Or if you have any questions, you can email me at jpwrestlingacademy@gmail.com. And the website has all the information you want, from how much it costs, the application, tells you a little bit about us, a little bit of who's been there, what they've done. jpwrestlingacademy.com.
There we go. And all the details are scrolled in along the bottom of the screen. Socials, as far as we can find out more information about JPWA. And if you wait until the end of the message, it's actually got the website address there, which has got the application process and the certain requirements that Dr. Tom and JPWA are after. You want people to have the right mindset and the right attitude before they even consider to fill out that application, don't you, Tom?
Well, we do, because we take it seriously. And, yeah, you know, while we do have fun, I take it seriously. If you're going to come and spend 3 months with us 5 days a week, I want everyone to be on the same page. It's one of those things that people don't know what to expect. And I understand that. But I have an acknowledgement letter and some things that we talk about. You know, the ropes aren't rubber bands and the ring's not a trampoline. So this isn't for everybody, and I understand that. But we've had some serious people come through. We've had some people that want to just have the experience, and that's cool too. If you want to come and experience what it's like to train as a professional wrestler, then we welcome that. But we also have some people who want to come in and actually do this for real, and that's the way I approach it. We do fundamentals and basics, and they never go out of style. And we go over it and over it and over it. So I think, anybody who's looking to not just have the experience, but also learn what professional wrestling is about, you can find out, come and check us out.
Absolutely. And all the details are on their website. So go and check that one out. I want to take a bit of a deep dive now into, firstly, your wrestling fandom, how kind of wrestling first came into your life, what sort of impact it had on you. And then we'll talk about certain moments within your career. But the Pritchard boys, yourself and Bruce, grew up in Houston, didn't you? Houston, Texas. And it was Paul Bosch and Houston Wrestling that really kind of pulled you in as fans in the 60s and 70s. And you mentioned earlier that you were 12 years old when you were kind of first started in the business, selling photos to magazines and newspapers. Is that right?
Well, that's right. But we actually grew up in El Paso first, and then we watched the West Texas part of wrestling. We watched the Funks, Ricky Romero, the Infernos, the Von Brauners, J.C. Dykes, Saul Weingroff, all these colorful characters in West Texas first. And then we moved to Houston when I was like 10 years old. And then we got to know Paul Bosch. And then we got to do all these things. You know, it was just in El Paso, wrestling was on a Monday night. So it was a school night. We couldn't go to wrestling all the time. And we were just young kids. And my mom and dad wouldn't take us. But when we got to Houston, it was on Friday nights. And my mom wanted to get out of the house. So what a better way to do it than take Bruce and me to the wrestling matches. Oh, and yeah, it was. And back then, it was a different business. We talked about old school a little earlier, but it really was a dark arena, the Sam Houston Coliseum. They would turn out the house lights and the ring lights would come on. And you could still smoke back then.
I was going to say, but it's very smoky back then.
Yes.
Barely see the ring.
Yeah, well, you could see the smoke up in the lights and around the ring and stuff like that, and it captivated us. We went every Friday night. The tickets were cheap. My mom wanted to get out of the house, so we went and made our presence known. We introduced ourselves to Paul Bosch, but the way I got my break, my brother Ken called Mr. Bosch one time, And I just got a brand new camera because I was looking for a way to get in the business, and I was going to take pictures for the magazines. I contacted Jim Melby with Wrestling News, and I wrote him a letter and told him I want to take pictures, and would you send me a press pass? Well, he sent me this little press pass. I don't know how official it was, but it was from Wrestling News magazine, and my brother called Paul, and he picked me up from school, took me downtown. We met Paul with Paul, and he agreed to let me shoot some pictures at ringside. They got published, and so I got to do it again and again. And then I explained to Paul that I wanted to wrestle. He said, "Yeah, you can't do that. You're too small." So that didn't deter me, because I was even more determined to lift weights, get bigger. And eventually, when I did that, I ran into Mark Lewin at the same gym I was working out at, and we started working out together. And one summer, my brother got me a job at this department store selling shoes. And after 2 weeks, I'm at the ticket office telling these ladies behind the counter how terrible this job was selling shoes. And Paul had come out of his office and he looked at me and said, "That job is going to give you stories to tell for the rest of your life. How would you like to work here?" He had just moved from one office to another. And he paid me $75 a week to work in the wrestling office, selling tickets, mowing the grass, doing errands, things like that. It couldn't have happened any better. It was like out of a movie, I guess. And I started working the summertime from the time I was 15 until the time I started wrestling. So it was very, very cool. I got to be around the wrestling business. I got to be around the office and taking people like Fritz Von Erich and Gary Hart to the airport, taking the guys after the matches, wherever they needed to go. So once I did that, and once I started wrestling, Bruce took up my spot. He got working in the office too, and refereeing and second and being Paul's assistant and things like that. So, yeah, it was very, very cool.
Let me just bring up some pictures here, because I'll be honest with you, Paul Bosch, obviously not as well-known, not as notorious as he is over in the North American, but having listened to various podcasts, and of course your brother speaks very fondly of Houston wrestling and Paul Bosch, but obviously he was very influential on you and all the talent and fans in around the area. But how influential was he on the North American scene and on yourself in particular? And I come across this photo here, and I think that's a very young Tom Pritchard there. I don't know whether you were still in your teens there, or maybe you had started training, but how influential was he, firstly, on the business and on you in particular?
Well, Paul was Morris Siegel's assistant in Houston, Texas, growing up, and he was one of the better payoff men in the business. He and Sam Munchnick, you know, Sam Munchnick was president of the NWA. And we're talking about the 50s, 60s, 70s, and somewhat in the 80s. So, I mean, we're in 2023. I don't know if anybody would really know Paul Bosch unless they were a historian and wanted to find out about Houston wrestling. There's some really great matches on YouTube out there, Houston wrestling, where Paul's commentating and things like this. But Paul was a well-respected promoter in Texas, and everybody wanted to work for Paul Bosch, just like they wanted to work for Sam Muchnick. Paul was known as an honest promoter. He would pay you probably more than you get anywhere in the territory. And there were times it was the Dallas territory when he was using the Dallas booking office, and then there was the San Antonio booking office. But everybody knew that Houston was a destination town. You know, you'd make your money. You can make as much on the first match, you can make $500.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's the kind of guy Paul Bosch was. He wanted to treat everybody fairly. And I don't think I've ever heard anybody say a bad word about Paul.
Yeah.
Absolutely. He was a great man. Plus, he gave me my opportunities. He gave Bruce his opportunities. So I think both of us are highly indebted to Paul Bosch. Without Paul, we wouldn't have been able to make it in business.
Skipping ahead a little bit here, I want to talk a bit about Continental Championship Wrestling if I can. And I think certainly a territory that gave you a lot of opportunities, some great memories, some great matches. Now, I believe that you are a multi-time champion over in Continental, which is based in Alabama, if I'm not mistaken. And you had a legendary feud with the dirty white boy, Tony Anthony, didn't you? And that always sticks out in my mind, and a lot of fans' minds, when they think about that particular part of your career. I think you guys feuded between 87 and 88, so that year, close to 2 year period. And I think that feud and that time in Continental really helped to put the two of you on the map at the time as well, didn't it, Tom?
It did. And when we talk about Alabama and the South and things like that, we were doing things differently than they would do it in New York or the West Coast, things of that nature, because Southern
was a story. Or the wrestling style, what would you class as different?
Yeah, the wrestling style. You know, I kind of diverting off here. Survivor Series in Boston, the Rock and Roll Express and the Heavenly Bodies had a match, and we thought it was a great match, but it was a Southern style match, and the people just shit all over us. They didn't care. They booed us out of the building. But that was what the Southern fans really liked to see. And Tony Anthony was a great worker. Dirty white boy, and we did an infamous angle where he hung me from the interview stand, drugged me all the way from the interview stand to the ring, my hands handcuffed behind my back. I was trying to tell him I was really choking, but there was no way to really talk or translate that. And back then we didn't rehearse anything. We didn't go over it. We talked about it, but we didn't have a chance to actually see how far we needed to travel from the interview platform to the ring and how long it would take. So we talked about hitting me in the back with a chair, handcuffing my hands behind my back, and then putting a noose around my neck and pulling me. And here I am trusting the white boy to pull me from this platform. Yeah.
But there's no easy way to do that without doing some serious harm, is there?
right. There was no easy way to do it. And I'm choking, and there's no way to tell him. But, you know, that was one of those things that people talked about for a long time. Mm. And, yeah, it did put us both on the map.
Absolutely. Now, I mentioned Johnny Saint. So my interviews with Johnny Saint, but that's part of a series. And I've interviewed the likes of Marty Jones and Exotic Adrian Street. Another gentleman that I've interviewed on my Legends Masterclass series is a guy by the name of Tony St. Clair.
Yes.
Now, in 1989, you did a stint, a bit of a tour over in New Japan, didn't you? And I think you teamed with Tony a few times towards the end of that tour. But tell us a bit about going over to Japan and experiencing the talent and the culture and the wrestling style over there and teaming with Tony, because when I interviewed Tony, he had fond memories of his time over in Japan. I think he may have also mentioned you as well.
Yeah, I've always had fond memories of Japan, and I like Tony. Tony St. Clair was a great guy, still a great guy. I think we exchanged messages via Facebook a couple times. Yeah, but New Japan, All Japan, I went for Wing. It was a great experience. People talk about how stiff it is in Japan. Well, I prefer the word solid. They're stiff, and stiff hurts, but solid, you're going to feel it, and it felt more real. And that was what Japan was trying to be. It was more of a realistic style, and you had guys like Tatsumi Fujinami, Saito, you had Inoki, you had Baba, you had all these guys, Tiger Mask. My God, Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask had some tremendous matches in Japan. Yeah, incredible. So, you know, I was excited every time I got to go to Japan. Some people hated it, some people dreaded it, but I was all in, man, because I knew it was going to be great matches, and I knew it was going to be great food, great traveling, and it was a different culture, but I really enjoyed going to Japan. Enjoy teaming with Tony too. Tony was a great guy.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. And he's fond memories of that time as well when I spoke to him. I want to talk a bit about Memphis now and the USWA. And Memphis has always been a hotbed for professional wrestling. And certainly when you were over there you know, obviously, I think it was ran by Jerry Lawler and the Jarretts at the time. But you had a fantastic feud with the likes of Lawler and Steve Kern, Jeff Jarrett and Robert Fuller in tag competition. And I think on occasions you even teamed with a gentleman by the name of Steve Austin, Stunning Steve Austin at the time, probably very, very early into his career. And you were probably looking after him and guiding him quite a bit. But any fond memories of working over in Memphis and USWA back in, I think, the early 90s now?
Yeah, Memphis. I've been to Memphis a few times and I hated it. But my last time there, I really did enjoy it because it was a good crew. And one of the things I remember about Steve Austin, it was myself, Steve, and a guy named Brian. Brian Lee. Just went blank for a minute. Lee. Primetime Brian Lee.
Big guy. And, he played the fake Undertaker, didn't he, in 95?
Yes. Well, we were riding back from a town one night, and Brian called himself Primetime Brian Lee, and Steve was Stunning Steve Austin. And I asked them both, what makes you so prime time and what makes you stunning? I mean, you have to find these characters, but they have to ring true. And, you know, so we had some good conversations and some good matches back then, too. Memphis was one of those territories where personal issues took the forefront. And they did stuff that a lot of people wouldn't touch. And Lawler, Jarrett, Robert Fuller, all those guys were hitting the realism in wrestling. Even though it could be hokey at times, though, the Memphis fans got into it. It was good old Southern wrestling.
Yeah,
and that's when I talked about having that match in Boston. We had some, it was a Southern wrestling match, and a lot of people up there in the Northeast didn't like that Southern wrestling style. But Memphis loved it, and you had guys like Moondogs, and Lawler was the king forever and ever and ever, and do these crazy matches and do these crazy things. But the people loved every minute of it. So I had a blast.
Absolutely, absolutely. And 1992 and Smoky Mountain now. And I'm going to bring up this picture here, see if it brings back any memories. But there's yourself, sweet Stan Lane over on the right-hand side, Jim Cornette in the middle, along with beautiful Bobby. But the heavenly bodies were formed, were created. I think up until that point, you're mostly known as a singles competitor, as a singles performer. The Heavenly Bodies kind of, they had a tremendous, tremendous run in Smoky Mountain. 8 times tag team champions, 5 times with Sweet Stan Lane and 3 times with the Gigolo Jimmy Del Rey. We'll talk about Jimmy in a minute, but whose idea was it to form the Heavenly Bodies? I'm guessing it's Jimmy's idea, and seems to be a little bit of a more up-to-date version of maybe the Midnights or something like that. But tell us about the origins of the Heavenly Bodies.
Well, I was on the end of my run in Memphis, and Jimmy was getting ready to open Smoky Mountain Wrestling, and he was going to bring Stan and Bobby in as the Midnights versus Rock and Roll Express. But Bobby had a contract he had just signed, and Stan and Jimmy had just had enough of WCW. So Jimmy had called me up and asked me if I'd be interested in forming a team with Stan, and he was thinking about calling it the Heavenly Bodies. And, of course, I'd just done about 2 years, or maybe 1.5 years in Memphis, and I was ready to leave. And it was right down the road in Knoxville. So I came in. We did the Heavenly Bodies, Stan and I. And that picture that we took was when Bobby was on loan from WCW. And came in, and we did an angle in Smoky Mountain, which was translated into Super Brawl, I believe it was. And it was Jim Cornette's idea. He was just rehashing the Midnight Express versus the Rock and Roll Express. But I was so fortunate, and I was so happy to do it, because I always liked Jim, always liked Stan, both very, very good guys and great to work with, had a lot of fun with them. So it was tremendous. I'm working with the Rock and Roll Express. What more could you ask for? It was like a night off every night. You enjoy it.
Yeah. And let's talk about that. Let's talk about the Rock and Roll Express, because I think the Heavenly Bodies and the Rock and Roll Express, they just go together so well, that the chemistry and the storytelling But you guys feuded for years. So some of the matches, because I don't think those two teams ever had an ordinary match. There was always some gimmick, some stipulation added to it, like a hospital elimination match. I don't know what that is, but it sounds really fun. Street fights, Texas death matches, steel cage matches, falls count anywhere. The loser gets tarred and feathered. But the Rock and Roll Express will go down in history as one of the greatest tag teams of all time. And it just sounds like the two teams just had so much fun when you were out there.
Well, it really was. If you couldn't work a match with Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson, you didn't belong to be in the business. And I always said that about Brad Armstrong, too. Brad Armstrong, by far, has to be my favorite singles opponent to work with. And no matter what, no matter who he was in the ring with, Brad, I'm talking about, if you couldn't have a great match with Brad, then you should get out of the business.
Such a natural talent.
Yes. Yeah. So the same thing with the Rock and Roll. You just had to pay attention to what was going on, and we had the spots. We knew how to call audibles. We knew how to switch gears, and it was great to work with those guys every single night because you didn't have to think about it. You just go out there and feel it. And Ricky Morton, to me, is still one of the greatest baby faces of all time.
Oh, and they're still going out there and performing, doing some wonderful things.
Well, Ricky's more or less teaming with his son these days, but
fantastic. A little bit of a change here, because in 93, the body is lost. A match against the Rock and Roll Express, the loser of the fall leaves Smoky Mountain. And by the looks of it, the person that was the recipient of that fall was Sweet Stan Lane. I think he possibly got signed up to the WWF at the time as an announcer or a commentator. And then in comes, we see the introduction of Gigolo Jimmy Del Rey. Now, for my money, Jimmy's one of these talents that was very, very natural, untapped, could do pretty much anything in the ring. A perfect fit for the bodies as well. Tell us about Jimmy coming into the team as a replacement for Stan.
Well, Stan, I think, had got a little tired of coming from Charlotte to Knoxville all the time. And he had already pioneered a couple territories, so he was tired. And he was ready to go. And when Jimmy Del Rey was suggested by Kevin Sullivan, because he was in Tampa, not really doing anything. And when Jimmy came in, I remember the first night, he's missing a tooth, he's smoking cigarettes, and a lot of the guys are looking around going, who in the hell is this guy? And we go to the ring. We laid out the match, and we go to the ring, and this guy blew everybody away, man.
Phenomenal.
He was phenomenal. He was phenomenal. And so he won Ricky Morton over, he won Robert over, he won us over, and he was a great talent in the ring. The only thing was, outside the ring, I'm the kind of guy like if we went somewhere, I want to lay back and I want to kind of check things out. I don't want to make a whole lot of noise when we walk in, but Jimmy wanted to let everybody know we're there, and you need to have that. But man, he was a little steam. Yes, he was a whirlwind. And I'm sitting back. I want to sit at a table, or I want to sit in a corner and kind of watch and kind of see what the lay of the land is. And we meshed in the ring pretty good. We meshed outside for a little bit until finally I said, I'm going to go there and you go over here. So,
I can see that. Tons of stories about Jimmy Del Rey, but if you're not familiar with who Jimmy Del Rey is, go and check it out. Go on the WWE Network or Peacock, go and check out Smoky Mountain, go and check out some of the body's matches in about 95, 96 on the WWE Network in WWE. And of course, in 93, you did get the call up. I think you had a few house show matches, and then I think your big really was SummerSlam 93 against the Steiners. Now, I vividly remember the episode of Superstars where you came out with Jimmy and with Jim Cornette. I wasn't too familiar with either of you, but that introduction, yourself with the hair and the brilliant gowns that you wore to the ring, and James E. with his tennis racket and his loud voice, what an introduction. But, I mean, how did you enjoy kind of moving into WWF? I mean, a completely different scene, a completely different landscape. Was you hesitant to start off with, and how did you fit in?
Well, I knew most of the guys that were there. I knew Razor.
Yeah, true.
You know, knew a lot of the guys who were already there, but I wasn't quite sure. And my brother was there, so I wasn't really too worried until we got there and we had our first TV match. And I remember the next day somebody said, Pat wants to talk to you, Pat Patterson. Here we're thinking he's going to tell us what a great match it was, but he told us how terrible we were. We didn't know how to work. We didn't know how to do anything. So it was like, oh my God,
what? This is not a how good could way that to be?
Yeah, well, it was. So, you know, after that, we kind of knew where we were standing and what we were doing. But I was happy to be there at the time. And, you know, you can't just be happy to be there. You have to be proactive. And I wasn't as proactive as I should have been. So that's on me. And we just, we did what we could do. And we got what we could get. And that was it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so we spoke about the Steiner 3 and you mentioned it earlier. You alluded to it, Survivor Series 93. I'm just going to bring up some pictures here. Firstly, of yourself and Jimmy in a WWF ring. There you are with the lovely wings on your costumes as well. I'm not sure whose idea that was, but you mentioned the Rocky.
Yeah.
was it your ideas?
No.
No.
No, that was a Vince deal. No, not at all. Yeah.
And then, of course, the Survivor Series, and they bring in the Rock and Roll. And, you know, as much as I love you guys and tag team wrestling, this match just felt out of place in a WWE ring. Yeah. And, of course, you competed over WWF ring. You competed over the Smoky Mountain titles. You won the match. Now, for my money, it was a really fun match. But it wasn't a WWF-style match, was it? And I don't think the fans really took to it.
No, they didn't take to it at all. Like I said, they booed us out of the arena. And once we got back, we went, oh, Jesus Christ. But, well, I mean, we for what it was a Rock and Roll Express Heavenly Bodies yes. match. And it, if we would have had it down in Knoxville, Tennessee, it would have been different. But it was in Boston, Massachusetts. So it didn't fit. You're 100% right. It did not fit what we were trying to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's just see where I am here. I don't want to lose my place. Now, you know, full transparency, massive fan of yours, massive fan of the Bodies. Do you feel that there were opportunities wasted or lost as far as giving the Bodies an opportunity or a run with the titles? I know that you had a run with the Smoking Guns when they were champions, and I think the Head Shrinkers when they were champions, mostly on the house show circuit. Was there ever a conversation had behind the scenes or maybe between yourself and James and the office guys about maybe putting the titles on you guys?
No, I don't really believe there ever was. And that, again, that's on us. We should have been more proactive. I should have been more proactive, but I was just, once Pat told us he thought we were the shits, I thought, well, that's pretty much done right there. But no, we just pretty much did our gig and came and went. So yeah. there was no talks about having a title run. I think before, when we first came in with the Steiners, Jimmy talked about bringing the Steiners down to Knoxville, and we were going to have a run for about a week there where we would switch the belts at the beginning of the week and drop them back to at the end of the week. But they were going to drop them to the Quebecers before they got to Knoxville. So that was the only talk that I ever heard about, you know, maybe doing it one, like a short run in Knoxville where they could say, hey, the Heavenly Bodies won the titles and that's it. But I don't even think they wanted to do that.
There we go. But, I mean, you had a good run there with Jimmy for yeah. a couple of years for sure. I want to take a switch it again back to Smoky Mountain in about 95. And it was the Heavenly Bodies versus, now let me just see, Tracy Smothers and the Dirty White Boy. Now, you probably know where I'm going to go with this, but we mentioned Jordan Sparks earlier on, and he pulled me to one side at a wrestling show a few weeks back and said, oh, when you speak to Dr. Tom, ask him about in Smoky Mountain when Tracy Smothers pole drove Dr. Tom through the table. Now, I've got some pictures just to kind of bring back the memories. Now, these aren't great pictures, but it was grainy footage. There you are, both as bloody as hell. And yeah. You're about to go through the table. Now, typically in table spots like this, the table would break in half. But no, you guys just went straight through, caused two body shaped holes, a crazy spot that's still remembered vividly today. I think Jim Cornette even brought it up recently on one of his podcasts, that kind of brought it back into the modern day. But tell us about that, and why did it go so wrong?
Well, what happened was, originally it was supposed to be where the dirty white boy shot me into Tracy, and he would backdrop me on the table, and the table was supposed to break. Well, when Tracy backdropped me, I slid across the table, and it didn't break. It was one of those heavy tables that the Coliseum had. It wasn't a gimmick table, and it was the Coliseum's table. So the idea was we needed to break the table to tell the story that we had already told on promos, and you know, we did promos before the match, and we knew it was going to happen, so we told the story. But we had to have that table break in order to make the story match up. So when I slid across the table, Tracy just grabbed me and said, "All right, we're going here now," and picked me up and piledrive me right through the table. So thank God none of us got hurt, but it was like, oh my God. Yeah, originally it was just supposed to be a backdrop and break, but it didn't happen so easy.
Yeah, absolutely. And fortunately, the two of you came out of it relatively unscathed, although it looked like a bit of a tight squeeze actually getting out of that hole, but you both managed it. I want to talk about this guy here now, Chris Carlino.
Chris, I was going to say, yeah.
No, and wow, a handsome looking dude on the right hand side as well. But terrible. Chris Candido, I mean, we talk about, you know, potential and untapped talent, and you know, guys that really could have gone all the way. We spoke about Jimmy Del Rey's and natural talents like that, but Chris Candido was another natural talent, and you had the pleasure of working with a guy, I think, for a very short period of time, maybe 8 or 9 months, in about 96, I think it was. But I mean, just gimmick aside, you know, just teaming with Chris, it wasn't great circumstances, but the two of you, I think, made a good team. Do you have fond memories of teaming with Chris?
I had fond memories of teaming with Chris. It was just, you're right, the circumstances weren't very nice. And it was one of those things that bittersweet, if you will, because of what we were around and doing at that time. But no, Chris was great. I've known Chris since he was a kid. When he first came to Memphis, and then when he came to Smoky Mountain. So I've known Chris for a while, and I knew about his passion. He was very, very passionate, in love with wrestling. You know, he'd been wrestling since he was a kid. His grandfather was a wrestler. So, Chuck Popeye something. And, you know, he fell in love with wrestling as a young age too. So, I knew how passionate he was about it. It just, I wish he could have been in different circumstances. They made him a joke, you know, the Body Donnas. He wasn't a Body Donna, man. I mean, he was Chris Candido, and he didn't need a gimmick to get over if you just let him do his thing. But once again, circumstances being what they were not ideal, to say the least.
I think with Chris Candido, he came up in the business in the wrong generation. I think had he have come up maybe, you know, 20 years later, he would have been, you know, not necessarily world champion, but he would have been thought of differently, I think. Love that.
Well, you know, Chris was the NWA world champion.
Yeah, very true. Very true. And I know that he had a good run in ECW as well and TNA. Fond memories, but like I say, the circumstances weren't great for sure. But I mean, you did get the opportunity as a WWF Tag Team Champions, didn't you? Now I'm going to flash up this picture here, but it was on a WrestleMania as well. WrestleMania, I can't remember exactly what year was it, 95?
WrestleMania 12. If that was 96.
Yeah. So, I mean, a big, momentous occasion. And, I mean, like I say, circumstances weren't great because of the gimmick and everything, but getting the opportunity to win the titles at such a big show, that must have been a bit of a thrill, a memory that lives quite fondly with you.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's again, that's that bittersweet thing. Of course, it was under the Body Donnas, but yeah, we won the WWF Tag Team Champions, and that's something we can't take away from us. So, yeah, it was kind of cool. Very cool.
Absolutely. As we start to wind down, Dr. Tom, and you've been a phenomenal guest, so I want to thank you so much. But, I mean, looking back over your, you know, 45-year career, 50-year career, if you go back to when you started selling photos as a 12-year-old, but what are some of your proudest moments of your career? And that can include what you've been doing recently with JPWA, but very fond memories that really kind of make you happy to have been in the wrestling business all these years.
Well, I think just the fact that I even got in to the professional wrestling was able to be a professional wrestler. That's one of my proudest moments. But after I retired, I think just the fact that I've been able to coach, teach, instruct, and help some of the guys get in the wrestling business is one of my proudest moments, especially since 1996, I've been coaching and training these guys. So that really is, it's an accomplishment. I get to live vicariously through them. No matter who it is, even if they go out on the independents and they fulfill their dream, then I feel proud of those guys. Yeah. They get to go out and prove everybody wrong who said they couldn't do it, because I understand what that's like. I understand what people tell you, no, 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 you can't. And finally you go out there and you do it. So I'm very proud of everybody that's come through, not just JPWA, but FCW, McDonough, Georgia, when we had the developmental system down there, OVW, everybody that's come through, man. That's what I think I'm most proud of these days is helping coach and train people along the way.
Absolutely. And Dr. Tom Pritchard, I just want to thank you so much for being a wonderful guest on episode 339 of Wrestling with Jonas. If you've got any parting words, any final words for my audience at home, for any of your fans, friends, followers that you'd like to sign us off with on this episode of Wrestling with Jonas, any final words from the Doctor of Desire, Dr. Tom Pritchard?
Well, just remember, don't let anybody tell you you can't. Live your dreams. Do what you want to do. And remember, there are three kinds of people in the world: those who try, and when they don't make it, they say at least I tried. Those who give it their best shot. When they don't make it, they say at least I gave it my best shot. But if you really want to do something, you got to do whatever it takes, and don't let anybody tell you you can't. I'm living proof that you can live your dream, and you can too.
There we go. Dr. Tom, thank you so much, and see you down the road, my friend.
Well, thanks for having me, John. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.